Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at a panel discussion on Proposition 1. Creators of the initiative are calling it the Anti-Corruption Act. Meanwhile, opponents of Proposition 1 have dubbed it the Alaska Gag Law. No matter what we call it, Alaskans will vote on Proposition 1 this August. Recorded on Thursday, May 6th, four Alaskans present their opposing views on Proposition 1 at a panel discussion hosted by the Resource Development Council for Alaska.
We're going to go ahead and get started this morning. Thank you for joining us. My name is Wendy Linskoog. I'm currently serving as your president of the RDC board, and I'm also vice president of corporate affairs for the Alaska Railroad. So it is my pleasure this morning to introduce not one speaker, but four different speakers. And here's how we're going to handle it. I will first introduce the proponents for the initiative. And we have two speakers there. They will have 15 minutes collectively to talk on their side of the initiative, and then I will introduce the opponents of the initiative, and they will have 15 minutes. So I think that's how we'll go ahead and handle this morning's panel. Jason Klein will be our first speaker. Jason Klein is a lifelong Alaskan, commercial fisherman, and graduate of UAA and the Anchorage School District. His work ethic has propelled him through employment in the public and private sector, spending most of his time in small business development. His desire for a sustainable economic future in Alaska has driven him to become engaged in several political organizations and endeavors. He joined Clean Team Alaska after seeing the problems with corruption throughout Alaska and how it has poisoned the political atmosphere. And Jason, if you can hold on 1 second, I'll go ahead and introduce Ken Jacobus as well, and then you guys can take the podium here. Kenneth Peter Jacobus is an attorney who has been in the private practice of law in Anchorage since 1969. He has lived in Alaska since 1969, started his legal career as a law clerk to Alaska Supreme Court Justice Jay Rabinowitz. Excuse me, was a principal partner in Hughes, Thorsness, Gantz, and Powell and Brendan from 1969 to 1990, and since then has practiced law as Kenneth P. Jacobus, PC. Among other things, Mr. Jacobus has been involved with numerous initiatives, including writing, circulating, and litigating initiative issues. He has been working in this area of law since the litigation over the signatures on the Anchorage Tax Cap Initiative in the early 1980s. This litigation resulted in the initiative being placed on the ballot and the passage of the tax cap by Anchorage voters. So if you would please help me welcome both of our speakers, the proponents of the initiative.
The national budget must be balanced. The public debt must be reduced. Arrogance of the authorities must be moderated and controlled. Payments to foreign governments must be reduced if the nation doesn't want to go bankrupt. People must again learn to work instead of living on public assistance. This is a quote from Cicero in 55 BC, but I think all of us can probably feel at what's going on right now with our entire nation. It's happened in Cicero's time, 55 BC, and it's happening to us now. We rail against these DC politicians because of the taxation, the spending, the corruption, the creation of burdensome regulation. But the truth of the matter is this: government has gone beyond its means in all levels and must be reduced if we're to have a sustainable and healthy economic future, not just in this state, but also in this nation. State governments like Alaska have to move to a system of fair taxation rather than confiscation. I think we can all realize this. We're in a state right now, as a state, we're in a crossroads right now, and I know I've heard plenty of politicians talk about this, that right now is the most important time because what we do now affects the next 50, 100 years in Alaska. And Andrew Halcrow actually pointed this out pretty well recently. He said, since the ACES tax hike of 2007, investment in new production, adding projects in Alaska's oil patch has been deferred. Well counts have declined. Workers have been laid off, and unemployment rate is in the highest in 18 years. Is this a sustainable future that publicly funded lobbying has worked to create? Or is this a state budget that's grown justified by municipal spending and pet projects? This is a serious enough issue that it has to be addressed if we are to start having a sustainable and real economic future in the state of Alaska. This is perhaps an ideological issue for myself, but I'm sure people can agree that government at all levels has grown well outside the scope of what it's meant to do. We heard today in the very first letter a misuse of capital funds, the misuse of public funds. The government was never meant to get into the use of lobbying itself for more money. I realized today that I'm sitting in front of a group who's probably not going to support this initiative because organizations like RDC and other organizations similar rely heavily on public funds to fund their operations and fund their membership. But again, are we worried about a sustainable economic future? I realize this, but I'm here, and I'm willing to talk about it, and I'm willing to have a healthy debate on the issue. You're all very smart people. There's no question. These are some of the smartest industry leaders in the room. I feel blessed to be able to speak in front of you today. And I'm not here to appeal to your hearts about this. I'm here to appeal to your minds. I'm hoping that as we've been requested, let's read this initiative. Let's talk about the merits of the legislation and what we can really do to start talking about a sustainable economic future, limited corruption, and open government. I'm hoping that at the end of the day, you at least leave with the question wondering, is this something I should support? Is this something that will really be effective in limiting government? And is this something that will open and have a fair and limited government? But the truth is this, in my opinion, we've lost the political will to govern ourselves. We now have publicly funded lobbying and campaigns that are driven by non-competitive government contract holder contributions, and this is just business as usual in the state. It's not even for some reason perceived as corruption anymore that we're using these sole source contracts and publicly funded lobbying to just run the state. This has created a political atmosphere in which legislators aren't held accountable, municipalities just assume that they're entitled to state government handouts, and public employee unions assume that the state works for them. Indeed, it seems that quite a few legislators perhaps actually do work for these employee unions, but that's another issue. Most citizens and government employees and even politicians agree, though, that this is not a sound governing strategy. Something must be done, but they feel that they can't do anything because this is business as usual. This is the norm in Alaska. We just wrapped up with a legislative session that dealt with two major issues pertaining to what we're talking about today. One of them, which I didn't think was a big deal, but one of the things we saw fit in the legislative session was to limit the amount of money a legislator can take in the form of a lunch from a lobbyist. If we don't think corruption and lobbying practices are a problem in Juneau, then why is it being addressed when we have a system of taxation in the oil company that is killing investment, killing the state's future, killing new development? Why are we discussing corruption? We got into ethics and disclosure laws. Ethics and disclosure laws merely address the symptoms. They do not address the root problems of corruption. They stifle citizen participation, neuter legislative power, and do nothing to prevent the behind-the-scenes lobbying and the corrupt pay-to-play practice that happens with conflicts of interest. Disclosing a conflict of interest, making it permissible, it makes about as much sense as letting someone into your safe, just so long as they smile and wave at your security camera on the way out. It does not address the real problems that we have with corruption in this state. Now, elected leaders and everybody in this room can probably agree that if we don't have a new petroleum income to fund this state in the next decade, we're going to have a whole different organization, economic organization in this state. Something must be done to address the problems of growing government and these pet projects and municipal spending that's justified and grown our state. But we have not found not one political leader, not one person who realizes it takes real leadership. And it's going to take some tough decisions in the short term if we're to have a real sustainable economic future, because we have a 6%, optimistic 6% decline in oil production and a correlating increase in the state budget. That's a problem because it's counterintuitive to basic math and basic budgeting. If the amount of 90% of your money is dwindling away at an optimistic 6% rate and you're increasing at more than an 8% rate, something is not going to work very soon. We have to start curbing the problems and justification of spending and start limiting where government does what government does, especially in a state which is full of these problems. We have to do this because people in this room, now there are a few candidates, but generally this is an initiative process. Ultimately, this is going to be voted on by the people. And the purpose of having this initiative process is that people aren't up for election next year. People get to realize that we're considering the next generation and not the next election. People realize that at the end of the day, we have to take charge because our political leaders have failed us in taking charge and doing something to curb this growth of government. And really, at the end of the day, we have to wonder, as I said, with an organization like the Resource Development Council, is membership to an organization like this more important than a sustainable economic future in Alaska? Because we knew we did something. So I'm going to address the main provisions of the initiative now that I've kind of introduced why I think it's necessary. The initiative does a few things. It, three main goals, in my opinion, open and transparent government. Right now, the city of Kodiak actually has an amazing system in which all government contracts are online, easily viewable by the public. You can see where the money's going. You can sort it by who got the money, what the money's for, what department. It's a very simple process. Why is the state not doing this? This initiative requires all government contracts with, I mean, and basically, and Ken will get into the legal language, but it works side by side with municipalities to create a more open and transparent government. Why is it so difficult to think that a government that is supposed to work by our side, not on our back, should be showing us where our money's going? Now, the state checkbook's a great step to this, but it does not go far enough. We don't see where the money, why this was spent, on what projects. All we see is money per person. It needs to go further. Why is, I mean, technology is so simple nowadays. Everybody in this room probably knows about Facebook and Twitter. I know the opposition has been using it quite heavily. And it's very simple the way information can be syndicated nowadays. This is a very simple step to an open government. And once people realize where the money's going, people are more apt to do something about fixing those problems. One of the second main provisions, we're hoping to stop publicly funded lobbyists. The idea that you can use taxpayer dollars to fund someone to go down and get more taxpayer dollars. This is an unhealthy, cyclical growth of government that the state cannot afford. Cannot. What we have now is a system in which we're taking money, coercing money out of members of organizations, coercing out of the taxpayers to fund to go get more of their money. So this is a practice, if we're going to limit government, limit the scope of what it does, it's a step towards doing that. And make no question, this initiative does hope to limit the growth of government and curb that. And I would implore anyone to tell me about some process that's doing more about that than this initiative will do. And the last thing I think that it's most important is that it starts to remove this conflict of interest play-to-play program in which people who can pay a candidate who's going to ultimately vote on the contract that won't be competitively bid. I mean, I think all of us in the room can agree about the powers of the competitive market and what it does. Why are contracts not being put out to bid? I know of a contract that was put out, could save the state $160 million if it was put out to a competitive bid, but it wasn't. It was sole source, and it's just a giant waste of money. We have people from the Alaska Policy Forum released a report about this new crime lab. We talk about waste and overgrowth of government. Nothing's been done. I mean, the Alaska Policy Forum has a great piece. If anybody hasn't read it on the crime lab, sorry. I recommend everybody does. And it's these problems in which people who will ultimately get to build these buildings and people who will get to have the contracts are in the process of paying the legislators in the room, making deals, making it so no one can competitively contract these bids. We're not saying that competitive contracting is required. We're saying you're free to enter into these no-bid sole source contracts. And if you want to enter into that, you're going to lose your ability as an organization to move money in campaigns, not limit the ability of your individuals within your organization. Limit the organization's ability to do that, because there's a serious problem with corruption in the state. If you look at what Governor Christie did, the first thing he did when he walked into office in New Jersey, limiting the ability of pay-to-play, the spending of by organizations to fund pay-to-play and corrupt. I mean, this is nine other states have done this. It's time for Alaska to get on board. I'm now going to hand it over to Ken Jacobus, who's going to get a little bit more into the issues. I thank you for having me here today, and I hope you can vote yes on Proposition 1 for limited government and clean, open government.
I'm going to shorten up my talk because of the time available. These issues are so important, a lot of time is necessary to discuss them and consider them. The Anti-Corruption Initiative has three main points. As mentioned, it bans the use of taxpayer funds to hire private lobbyists to lobby for more taxpayer funds. It does not prohibit state or municipal officers from contacting legislators and asking the legislator for funds and laws to satisfy local government or state government needs. I won't talk about it any more than that because you can read the initiative. The other thing is that public contracts are to be placed on the internet in a user-friendly, searchable form so that the information is available to the public. This is already done in several states, and by at least one municipality in the state of Alaska. It's not a big it's maybe a slightly big project, but it's important to have this information available to the public. I won't discuss this point either, but the third point I'll discuss a little bit more. It places limitations on public contracts, and what it says is that any entity which hires a legislator or staff member may not get a public contract for 2 years after that person's term is completed. There's a huge exception to this, which maybe almost swallows the rule here. But if the legislator or staff member was engaged in or certified for a certain profession or occupation prior to becoming a legislator, that legislator can continue on in that profession or the same occupation with the same employer or a different employer without becoming subject to that exception. It doesn't apply to that. What it really does, the whole idea is to ensure that the public contract is not awarded, and then the legislature or staff member immediately compensated with a job in return for directing the public contract to a certain company. Okay, that's what we're trying to do. The initiative was attempted to be carefully written to address one type of corruption, which is corruption in the eyes of almost everybody, and that's which is trading public contracts for political contributions or jobs. This is really all the initiative does when you come right down to the bottom of it. Now, I was going to spend some time analyzing the particular provisions of it and some of the statements that have been made, but Clean Team Alaska provided something which says 10 lies about Proposition 1. I prefer to say 10 misrepresentations, misconceptions, whatever. I don't want to accuse the opponents of lying. But read these. These correctly state what the effect of the initiative is. And it's basically what the initiative will not do, which people claim it's going to do. That was going to be the entire second part of my discussion, but you've got it in paper. Third part of my discussion is that I believe that enacting this initiative is the right thing to do. And there have been a lot of false claims which have been made. Now, even if you accept the false claims, there are certain things you need to remember. And just remember all of these when you consider it. First, everyone has the constitutional right to free speech, political association, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Anyone will be able to talk to any elected or appointed official or government body to try to resolve their own problems or seek legislation or other government action of any type. The initiative does not interfere with this, and it cannot interfere with this as a constitutional matter. This law is not a gag law, as it's been called. People are as free after the law is enacted to communicate with the government as they were before. You can go to your city council and get your mill rate reduced. You're not gagged. The only thing is just no trading public contracts for jobs or campaign contributions. That's all it is. It's not intended to shut anybody up, and it does not shut anybody up. It can't shut anybody up as a matter of the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the federal Constitution. Second thing is this is a complicated area, and of course the initiative is not perfect. And this was quoted to me before the meeting, don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. What can happen if there are any problems with it, and some problems have been discussed with me already, the legislature is free to amend the initiative at any time. It can't repeal it for 2 years. It can make changes any time if there are any problems with it, such as dues to trade associations. If that's a problem, that can be dealt with at the beginning of the 2011 legislative session. Anyway, amendment is all right at any time, and any problems which exist in something which, of course, is complicated and can't be perfect can be dealt with. Third, the initiative has a severability clause, and if there's anything wrong with the initiative, constitutionally wrong, the court will simply take that portion out of the initiative and the remainder of the law is given effect. So anything that's wrong with it can be carved out by the court or, you know, by the legislature. Finally, since the initiative has criminal sanctions for violation, it's construed in favor of the person against whom the law is applied. anything which is arguable is interpreted in favor of the alleged violator. This principle provides further protection to someone to whom the law might be applied. So there's another protection there. Basically, the initiative hurts no one. But it does affect those people and entities who have been feeding at the really at the public trough for decades without anybody interfering with them because of political trade-offs, campaign contributions, friendships maybe, and do not want their feeding disturbed. That's all. Changes are needed. The point is, we do not want public contracts traded for public jobs or political public contracts traded for any jobs or political contributions. We would like to see more competitive bidding and more fewer no-bid contracts. We want information available to the Alaska voters by posting public contracts on the internet. And as a basic bottom line, all of this, we want to increase the private businesses in the state of Alaska and decrease the government expenditures, and the government influence over what all of us are trying to do here in this room, and that's to develop the resources of the state of Alaska so that we have a good future. This will help. Thank you very much. We'd appreciate your vote on this, vote yes on Proposition 1.
Thanks, Jason and Ken. All right, so they had 17 minutes. I'm going to make sure that we keep it all even here. We have two opponents who will be speaking to that side of the initiative. Kathy Wasserman is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. Before joining the staff of AML, Kathy served as the former mayor of Pelican, the past president of the Alaska Conference of Mayors, and the former business owner of Solutions, which was a municipal consulting company. Kathy came to Alaska in the mid-1980s as an archaeologist. Joelle Hall is the director of operations for the Alaska AFL-CIO. She began her career in Alaska politics as a University of Alaska Fairbanks intern for then Representative Fran Ulmer. After running campaigns in the 1994 cycle, she became the executive director of the Alaska Democratic Party, serving for the 1996 and 1998 campaign cycles. In 1999, she opened her own consulting firm and has recently came to work for the AFL-CIO full-time. In a previous life, Joelle was an interrogator, paratrooper in the U.S. Army, and an AFS exchange student to Honduras. So help me welcome both Kathy and Joelle.
Thanks. I always have a few little brief notes, which I'll speak off of, but I just wanted to say after listening to Mr. Jacobus, I feel so much better knowing that if I vote for this imperfect ballot initiative, that it can be fixed in a couple of years. I guess that would be my main beginning. Why would we vote for something that is so wrong that it has to be fixed in a couple of years? Meanwhile, what happens and how much more money is wasted or spent on trying to fix things that we knew weren't going to work from the beginning? I want to start off by saying at the very outset that this is a bad initiative. This has some huge ramifications, and it will affect everyone in this room negatively. First of all, if it's just trying to make sure that there's no trade-off of money, campaign money for contracting, why did it take 5 pages to say that? I was kind of worried we inundated you all with paper, and the opponents of this initiative passed out the initiative to you, and I was worried then you'd have two, because obviously they would pass out the initiative, but the proponents forgot to pass the initiative out so that you could read it. There are 5 pages. Read it. Please read it. I have read it I don't know how many times, and I still don't quite understand it. It blocks someone from doing something, and then 3 paragraphs later it says, oh, wait, they're an exemption, and then it goes back. It's very confusing, and it's very difficult to argue because there are so many parts of it, and I'm sure no one quite understands it. This initiative was placed before the voters in other states as well, most recently South Dakota. South Dakota spent about $1.2 million to fight this initiative because it sounded on the outside, I mean, anti-corruption. Aren't we all against corruption? Of course we are. But So it places people like us to say, well, we're anti-corruption. I mean, come on. This is craziness. In South Dakota, they spent their $1.2 million letting the people know what this initiative would really do and how it would affect them. And it was voted down. It was voted down in all the states in which it was placed by this gentleman from New York City, who then brought it here to us. Except in Colorado, a part of it was taken because they have the one subject rule in their initiative. It was voted up in Colorado and accepted. And then 2.5, 3 years later, just recently, it was deemed unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional. It takes away your rights. When you tell your children, get involved in your government, do what you can, and then you have an initiative that says, oh, but wait, do you have a contract with the government? A lot of the organizations in this room do, from selling file folders or selling oil or, as the mayor of a small community, if this had hit my community of Pelican and the fellow who lived across the boardwalk from the city hall had the contract to fill the city hall's oil tank, and if he could not take part in any other initiatives or campaign money, and all of his relatives were to be included, believe me, in a small community, we're all related. That would be everyone in town. If you'll look, read the initiative, you'll find the language that tells you that if you do have a contract above a certain amount, and they will say sole source, okay, whatever kind of a contract, it will not only prohibit you from taking part in campaigns, it will impact your spouse, your child, your spouse's child, your son, your daughter-in-law, your parent, sibling, grandparent, grandchild, stepbrother, stepsister, stepparent, parent-in-law, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, aunt, uncle, niece, nephew, guardian, and domestic partner. Your pets are about the only ones left that will be able to take part in anything. Again, we think this is a very, very bad initiative. We first of all, mostly just request that you read it and try to make sense of it. We would also encourage you to look at our website, stopthegaglaw.com. We not only have the initiative online, but we also have the Attorney General's opinion on it. He says many times that he believes it is unconstitutional. But of course, in the state of Alaska, that can't be deemed such until it actually becomes a law. There are too many unknowns in this thing. Just way too many unknowns. And why would we vote for anything that we weren't sure about the ramifications of? Look at the recent initiative that we had. It certainly came out a lot differently than a lot of people thought. And meanwhile, we've been in a legislative, political, legal quandary because of it. And it's wasted and spent a lot of time and money. So I'll give to the next person.
I'm Joelle. Thanks a lot for having us here today. I'm going to give most of my time to Jeff Feldman, who's agreed to join us today, who's our counsel. But on your tables, we handed out this document right here. This is a page out of alleged legal opinion procured by Mike Chenault, the Speaker of the House, having to do with whether or not Arctic Power would be able to be funded if this initiative were to pass. And the attorney and the alleged legal department finds that should this initiative pass, the state of Alaska would not be able to contribute money to lobby the federal government to open up the ANWR, to Kenai liquefied natural gas, you name it. We would not be able to go to the federal government to have our conversations as a state using state resources to do so. I think that's really important to the people in this room. I think that there's, as Kathy said, there's lots of unintended consequences. This is somebody else's legal opinion. This is not ours or theirs. So I urge you to read the Attorney General's opinion. I urge you to do some research on this. There is lots of fact available in lots of these ballot initiatives. It gets confusing, and people are going to say what they believe to be their version of the truth. There's already at least 5 legislative legal opinions on this issue. So I urge you to find those, and they will be on our website. The AG's is there right now. Thank you.
Good morning. I was asked to take a look at the initiative and provide some legal guidance to those who are opposed to it as a matter of policy. And, you know, the focus of my interest is the legal aspects of the initiative and the extent to which it either is or is not constitutional. And it takes a salutary goal. I was inspired by the passion of our first speaker. No one can be in favor of corruption, obviously. And it takes the aspect of that involves political speech and political contributions, which I think we all recognize is an area of life that is fairly sensitive, and the courts have dealt with a fair degree of care. And it takes, it applies a solution that really requires a scalpel and instead uses a chainsaw. And as is always the case when we're talking about legislation, and particularly legislation and political activity, the devil is always in the details. In the abstract, it sounds fine when you say we shouldn't be taking public money and using it to lobby to get more public money. That actually sounds like it might make some sense. But if you think about the real-world consequence of how political speech in Alaska in particular is manifested, it really doesn't make any sense at all. You know, for example, legislature, as we know, has the responsibility by Constitution of appropriating money every year. If you are a resident in Brevig Mission or Queftbluck or Igigik, and you want to explain to the legislature why your city, why your village needs a new water treatment facility, how do you do that? How do you make your political speech heard by those who have the responsibility and the power to act on it? Well, this initiative, if enacted into law, would forbid not only Brevig Mission hiring a lobbyist to go to the legislature and explain the community's needs, which I think we all would agree is a reasonable thing for a community to do. It would even prevent Brevig Mission from paying the cost of a plane ticket to fly one of its citizens to go to Juneau to explain its needs. So if you're Brevig Mission, how do you get your water treatment plant? And it's a little bit naive, with all due respect to the proponents of the initiative, it's naive to think that our state is going to function, particularly outside the urban areas, by telling people in our state that the way they obtain support from their state government and obtain funding for very worthwhile projects is for individual citizens to get on airplanes at substantial cost and go lobby the legislature one-on-one. Political speech does involve me having the right to petition my government, but it also involves groups of citizens and communities of citizens gathering together and using their joint resources to make their voice heard. In the courts, this is not me expressing a view of policy, this is me expressing a view of law, because the courts have been very, very protective, as evidenced most recently by the United States Supreme Court's decision this year, as I'm sure you all know, in the Citizens United case. The courts have been particularly protective of the opportunity of people to make their political voice heard. And this initiative, with all due respect, muzzles political speech. It muzzles the opportunity for a lot of people in the state to make their voice heard on matters of significant public interest, and not make their voice heard to corrupt the legislature or to unfairly or improperly influence the process by which work is done in Juneau. It muzzles them from making their proper voice heard on very worthwhile projects. The initiative runs headlong into so many legal issues and so many legal problems that it's inconceivable to me as a lawyer that it would withstand court scrutiny. Now, that may or may not be a reason for people to vote for it. People usually vote for things that they like, not whether they think a court will or will not sustain it. But the legal opinions that have already been authored by others on this initiative have identified many of the legal defects. And I'll just identify a few for you right here. The first and foremost is the one that I've just referenced, which is the improper and untenable constraint on First Amendment rights on political speech. Secondly, because it imposes as a sanction a prohibition on certain individuals holding public office if they accept money or if they violate provisions of the initiative, it actually indirectly attempts to impose additional qualifications on holding public office. Under Article 2, Section 12 of our state constitution, Only the legislature, each house, is responsible for setting the qualifications of its membership. And so this initiative seeks to have individual citizens by the enactment of initiative, instead arrogate to themselves a power that by Constitution is reserved for the individual bodies of the legislature. In that respect, the initiative is in fact unconstitutional. It is not narrowly tailored, as First Amendment cases, or both state cases and federal cases, require. And so to that extent, it runs afoul both of the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment of the federal Constitution. The legislature has a constitutional right to appropriate funds for any public purpose. And so to the extent that this initiative would prevent the legislature, for example, from appropriating public funds to lobby Congress, whether for ANWR or anything else, it would run afoul of Article 9, Section 6 of our state constitution. It is 5.5 or so single-space pages long. We could stand here all day, and I could discuss with you all the various and sundry ways in which it runs afoul of existing constitutional law. But suffice it to say that it will be if Mr. Jacobus is looking for yet another opportunity to litigate another initiative case, this is the one. This is the mother of all opportunities for litigation. It's going to make a great deal of work for lawyers. We'll be very busy. But the main concern that I think everybody should have is not to be misled by the headlines. It's very easy to say this is a great initiative because it would stop corruption, or this is a great initiative because it would stop the use of public funds to lobby for more public funds. The thing that scares me most about this initiative is that its real effect on how the world really will work, what its impact will be on organizations like this organization and other organizations that have members that in part are funded by public funds. Explaining that story is a lot more complicated, and explaining why it's unfair and why it's going to be hurtful to people is very complicated. And I'm concerned about whether, for example, the citizens in Anchorage will be sensitive enough and concerned enough about the rights of their fellow citizens in places outside of Anchorage to understand the overwhelmingly potent effect it's going to have on their ability to have their voice heard in Juneau. There may be a lot of things that we ought to do to try and make the process by which contracts are awarded and speech is heard in Juneau functional differently. I can say without question that I don't think that this initiative is quite the vehicle that we would want to use. On the contract part, which I assume is the portion that is of significant interest to the members of this organization, it's equally troublesome. A holder of a contract is not what you might think. Under the initiative, a holder of a contract is anybody who owns 5% of an entity that happens to hold a contract. So if you own even a very small portion of an entity that has a contract with the state of Alaska, you are subject to this initiative. Doesn't define what a contract is. Now, ask yourself the following question. Does it make sense as a matter of public policy that someone who holds a mining lease, which I would submit is a contract, is a public contract, does it make sense to say that someone who holds a mining lease in the state of Alaska should not be permitted to make a political contribution or to support a ballot initiative to make his First Amendment voice heard in the political process? It doesn't even stop with just the 5% owner, though, or just the mining lease owner. The initiative's prohibitions apply, as previously was mentioned, to family members. So the restriction is not only that the 5% owner of the company can't engage the political process, but all his family members are likewise precluded. We're talking about silencing a whole community of people in this state from participating in the political process. Attacking corruption is undeniably a good thing. Why would we would want to silence so many people in this state, many of whom, presumably, if they have contracts with the state of Alaska, are actually doing good things, and they are the very people that we would want to participate in, whose voices we would want to hear in the public debate? Why we would want to silence them is not at all clear to me. We're going to have some time for questions here, and I hope that that each of you will maybe give us some hard questions and put us to the test. As much as anything else, I would just encourage everybody to read the initiative very, very carefully, and as well as read the descriptions of what it will and won't do. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on Proposition 1, known as the Anti-Corruption Act or the Alaska Gag Law, recorded on May 6th at a breakfast meeting hosted by the Resource Development Council for Alaska. Jason Klein from Clean Team Alaska and attorney Ken Jacobus, also from Clean Team Alaska, spoke in the first half of the program on why Alaskans should vote yes this August. In the second half, Kathy Wasserman from the Alaska Municipal League and Joelle Hall with their attorney Jeff Feldman responded on why Alaskans should oppose Proposition 1. Following all of their individual presentations, the panel responded to questions from the audience. The first question was addressed to Ken Jacobus, asking, would in fact a mining lease in Alaska be considered a contract? And if yes, would that exclude a corporation, native or non-native, from doing any lobbying?
No, the thing that's really interesting about this, mining lease is a good example, because the what the initiative specifically says, and you have to look at this precise language, no holder of public office or candidate for that office, and then it says, with responsibility for the award of the contract. So the only person, the only public official this applies to is the person who awards the contract, who signs the contract. The mining lease probably comes from the Department of Natural Resources. It doesn't come from a legislator. So you can contribute funds to a legislator. It doesn't prevent that. The important thing is ultimately responsibility for the award of the contract. There was an example here which was passed out, I don't think it was passed out here, about somebody in the Wasilla selling snow machines to the state troopers, and that claimed that that would prevent the snow machine seller from making political contributions to candidates. Well, no. The only thing that would prevent was for the snow machine seller from making a loan to the purchasing agent for the state troopers, or from saying to the state trooper that, look, you know, I hear you're going to retire, buy these snow machines from me and then come to work for me and sell snow machines after your retirement. Contracting is not done by the individual legislators, except to the extent that maybe he's purchasing some supplies or something for his office. So, you know, just because a person has a government contract, like a mining lease, the operative language is the responsibility for the award of the contract. That's where the prevention is. It's not with everybody in the state. It's not with all the legislators. It's just the person with whom the private person is dealing. So the mining lease person, since he doesn't get a lease from the legislature, can contribute to legislative races and anything else. Doesn't hurt mining people at all.
Don't laws already exist that would prevent the snow machiner from hiring the state trooper in exchange for a contract?
Oh, that's true. That's bribery would prevent that, but there's no law presently which would allow the snow machine guy to give money or lend money to the state trooper without a quid pro quo of the direct snow machine purchase. But here, with the snow machine purchase, you can't tell. Well, it's less clear that you're buying a contract. You're just you get a contract, you're loaning money. That's prohibited. It's the intent of buying the contract is not required by this, but it's required by the bribery law. So, but anyway, it's the person you're dealing with that you have to look at. If you're not specifically dealing with a legislator on the contract, you're okay to contribute to legislators.
So why do we need this law if we don't deal with legislatures in trying to get contracts?
Well, you do sometimes. Like I say, if a legislator purchases something for his office. But on the other hand, it's this particular part of it is not intended to prevent people from contributing to legislators if the contract is not with the legislator. Ultimately, responsibility for the award of a contract means that you're not going to be allowed to influence people at the lower levels who actually award these contracts, or perhaps the commissioners who actually sign these contracts.
Attorney Jeff Feldman for the opposing side of the act also responded to questions
asked of Mr. Jacobus.
I don't read Section 2B of the initiative quite the way Mr. Jacobus does, so that's just a matter about which I guess lawyers will differ. The Initiative Act is also framed in terms of, not quite the way it was described, as the magic words are ultimate authority. Ultimate authority, I'm not sure who has ultimate authority over every contract in Alaska. There are some contracts that, in fact, are approved and issued, authorized by legislative committees. Presumably, they are the ultimate authority as to those contracts, and the restriction on contributions would apply to each and every member of those legislative committees as well. Ultimate authority is not a term that's defined, as far as I'm aware, in any case that's ever been decided in Alaska. And although there's a definitional section in this initiative, ultimate authority is not defined anywhere in the initiative as well. So there's a big hole in the initiative that I don't know anyone that could say reliably what the limits of how that would be applied would be under these circumstances.
Another audience member asked the panelists to explain how lobbying would work within the municipality if Proposition 1 was passed. Is it correct that the municipality of Anchorage would be prohibited from hiring a contract lobbyist to represent them in Juneau or various projects? Would they also be prohibited from having a legislative director of government affairs on the municipal payroll who would essentially be doing the same thing?
Jeff, do you want to go first, and then we'll let Ken if there's a difference of opinion?
Yes. The answer is yes.
I think we disagree on this a little bit. And this is one of those areas of disagreement. But it's pretty clear that the mayor, members of the city council, public officers can go down to can lobby. Whether the employees can or not, I think the employees can. I think the what this is directed at is hiring outside lobbyists and paying private lobbyists a lot of money to go sit down on the bench in the second floor in Juneau and stay down there for 4 months out of the session. And so I personally would say employees, yes, public officers, yes, private lobbyists, no.
What is the difference between the municipality of Anchorage having a lobbyist in-house, like BP, ConocoPhillips, or any other multinational corporation, versus someone not on staff?
Because it's kind of interesting. Personally, let me back up. It's clear that the people who should be talking to our legislators are our elected representatives. The mayor and the people that we elect to represent us should be going down to Juneau to talk to the state to get what we want. Now, they can send employees down there. Why is that different from hiring a private person to go down there? In a lot of ways, it isn't. And the private contract lobbyist can just become an employee of the municipality for 4 months in order to avoid the law. But we can't stop everything. I mean, and there's also another good reason for it, and that's if the Anchorage hires an employee to go down there and lobby for Anchorage, that person, the employee, will be lobbying for Anchorage. A person who's a private lobbyist will not only be lobbying for Anchorage, but for Fairbanks, Valdez, Tetitlik, all of his clients who may have conflicting interests. So what you do is you get the person who's going to lobby for your city focused on the interests of your city if that person is an employee. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to read the first sentence of the initiative. No public body, public officer, person in the employ of the state, any of its political subdivisions, any school district, or candidate for public office may directly or indirectly direct, permit, receive, require, or facilitate the use of tax revenues or any public resources for campaign, lobbying, or partisan purposes, including payment of dues for membership fee of any kind to any person, league, or association which directly or indirectly engages in lobbying, campaigning, or partisan activity. Very clear.
Unclear, but.
The last question from the audience was posed to Kathy Wasserman from the Alaska Municipal League. The audience member asked, do you support the Anchorage School District, for example, spending thousands of dollars in taxpayer money on marketing groups like school bonds? Yes, as opposed to being spent in the classroom.
Well, sir, with all due respect, not being a resident of Anchorage, I'm not going to take a position on what, how Anchorage municipality or school district spends their money or how they choose to do those things. In theory, I would love to see more money go for the classroom. But in many cases, whether you're for a lobbying group or against them, many of them have goals that indeed try to do that, try to bring more money to the classrooms. Whether you are, I'm sure there are some groups that you are in favor of that do the same thing. I mean, that's how our system works. I think some of those, Jeff, did you want to answer that? Okay. Better with legal stuff.
The answer to your question, I think, is for anyone who's unhappy that the school board would spend money advancing the adoption of or the passage of bonds, the remedy is to express their will at the ballot box when the school board members are up for re-election. I think that's a much more direct and appropriate way to express that view than to try and adopt a very broad prohibition on political speech. You know, if the citizens of Anchorage really want their public money to be spent in that way, and they are fully supportive of their school board of spending $50,000 explaining to the public what the bonds are for and how they would improve the quality of education, I think that's a matter for the citizens of Anchorage to decide. And I don't think putting a muzzle on the school board or putting a muzzle on the process, and particularly a muzzle that is so broad that it's going to have the indirect consequence of muzzling not only that kind of speech, but a whole other range of speech as well. I think that's tantamount to, you know, trying to attack a little problem with a nuclear weapon.
I'll just give an opportunity to respond to this, too. I do not believe that public money should be spent by a municipality or by a school district to campaign for or to campaign against a ballot proposition. I think that like the state puts out an election pamphlet, which gets information to the voters, the municipality can explain within limits as to what the thing is about, but I don't think that there should be an expensive campaign orchestrated by the public with public funds, with TV and that type of thing, radio, to try to convince the people to vote one way or the other. It's just as bad as trying to, the municipality spending money to try to convince them to vote for one candidate or another. And that's public. Public debate like this should be sponsored by the private sector, not by the municipality. This is clean. This is your clean elections thing, too. You know, pay for the elections. I'll take that back. That's different. But we shouldn't be spending our public money to espouse one person's position over another person's position. Thank you.
This is KESKA's Addressing Alaskans, and you've been listening to a panel discussion on Proposition 1. Jason Klein and Ken Jacobus both spoke in the first half of the program in support of what they call the Anti-Corruption Act. Then you heard from the opponents who call Proposition 1 the Alaska Gag Law, Kathy Wasserman from the Alaska Municipal League, Joelle Hall from the Alaska AFL-CIO, and their legal counsel, Jeff Feldman, spoke in the second half. Following each presentation, the panelists all responded to questions from audience members. The Resource Development Council hosted the panel discussion on Proposition 1, recorded at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage on Thursday, May 6, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.